as though uncertain.
Bigger? Britton asked. Is this the man Miss Dalton brought here last night?
Jan's lips parted. He stared at Britton, then at Bigger. Yelsa? Bigger whispered, struggling to control his feelings, hating Jan violently because he knew he was hurting him, wanting to strike Jan with something because Jan's wide, incredulous stare made him feel hot guilt to the very core of him.
You didn't bring me here, Bigger, Jan said. Why do you tell them that?
Bigger did not answer. He decided to talk only to Britton and Mr. Dalton. There was silence. Jan was staring at Bigger. Britton and Mr. Dalton were watching Jan. Jan made a move toward Bigger, but Britton's arm checked him.
Say, what is this? Jan demanded. What are you making this boy lie for? I suppose you're going to tell us you weren't drunk last night, huh?
Asked Britton.
What business is that of yours? Jan shot at him. Where's Miss Dalton? Britton asked.
Jan looked round the room, puzzled.
She's in Detroit, he said. You know your story by heart, don't you? Britton said. Say, Bigger, what are they doing to you? Don't be afraid, speak up, said Jan.
Bigger did not answer. He looked stonily at the floor.
Where did Miss Dalton tell you she was going? Britton asked. She told me she was going to Detroit. Did you see her last night?
Jan hesitated.
No. You didn't give these pamphlets to this boy last night.
Jan shrugged his shoulders, smiled, and said,
All right, I saw her, so what? You know why I didn't say so in the first place. No. We don't know, Britton said.
Well, Mr. Dalton here doesn't like Reds, as you call them, and I didn't want to get Miss Dalton in trouble.
Then you did meet her last night.
Yes.
Where is she?
If she's not in Detroit, then I don't know where she is.
You gave these pamphlets to this boy?
Yes, I did.
You and Miss Dalton were drunk last night.
Aw, come on, we weren't drunk. We had a little to drink.
You brought her home about two?
Bigger stiffened and waited.
Yeah? You told the boy to take her trunk down to the basement?
Jan opened his mouth, but no words came. He looked at Bigger, then back to Britton.
Say, what is this?
Where's my daughter, Mr. Erlon? Mr. Dalton asked.
I tell you, I don't know.
Listen, let's be frank, Mr. Erlon, said Mr. Dalton. We know my daughter was drunk last night when you brought her here. She was too drunk to leave here by herself. Do you know where she is?
I didn't come here last night, Jan stammered.
Bigger sensed that Jan had said that he had come home with Mary last night in order to make Mr. Dalton believe that he would not have left his daughter alone in a car with a strange chauffeur. And Bigger felt that after Jan admitted that they had been drinking, he was bound to say that he had brought the girl home. Unwittingly, Jan's desire to protect Mary had helped him. Jan's denial of having come to the home would not be believed now. It would make Mr. Dalton in Britton feel that he was trying to cover up something of even much greater seriousness.
You didn't come home with her? Mr. Dalton asked.
No.
You didn't tell the boy to take the trunk down?
Hell no. Who says I did? I left the car and took a trolley home.
Jan turned and faced Bigger.
Bigger, what are you telling these people?
Bigger did not answer.
He's just told us what you did last night, Britton said.
Where's Mary?
Where's Miss Dalton? Jan asked. We're waiting for you to tell us, said Britton.
Didn't she go to Detroit? Jan stammered.
No, said Mr. Dalton.
I called her this morning and Peggy told me she had.
You called her just to see if the family had missed her, didn't you? Asked Britton.
Jan walked over to Bigger.
Leave him alone, Britton said.
Bigger, Jan said. Why did you tell these men I came here?
You say you didn't come here at all last night,
Mr. Dalton asked again.
Absolutely not. Bigger, tell him when I left the car.
Bigger said nothing.
Come on, Airlone. I don't know what you're up to, but you've been lying ever since you've been in this room. You said you didn't come here last night, and then you said you did. You said you weren't drunk last night. Then you say you were. You said you didn't see Miss Dalton last night. Then you say you did. Come on now. Tell us where Miss Dalton is. Her father and mother want to know.
Bigger saw Jan's bewildered eyes.
Listen, I've told you all I know, said Jan, putting his hat back on. Unless you tell me what this joke's all about, I'm getting on back home.
Wait a minute, said Mr. Dalton. Mr. Dalton came forward a step and fronted Jan. You and I don't agree. Let's forget that. I want to know where my daughter is.
Is this a game? Asked Jan.
No, no, said Mr. Dalton. I want to know. I'm worried.
I tell you, I don't know.
Listen, Mr. Airlon, Mary is the only girl we've got. I don't want her to do anything rash. Tell her to come back, or you bring her back.
Mr. Dalton, I'm telling you the truth.
Listen, Mr. Dalton said. I'll make it all right with you. Jan's face reddened.
What do you mean? He asked.
I'll make it worth your while.
You son.
Jan stopped. He walked to the door.
Let him go, said Britton. He can't get away. I'll phone and have him picked up. He knows more than he's telling.
Jan paused in the doorway, looking at all three of them. Then he went out. Bigger sat on the edge of the bed and heard Jan's feet run down the stairs. A door slammed, then silence. Bigger saw Mr. Dalton gazing at him queerly. He did not like that look. But Britton was jotting something on a pad, his face pale and hard in the yellow glare of the suspended electric bulb.
You're telling us the truth about all this, aren't you, Bigger?
Mr. Dalton asked.
Yes, sir.
He's all right, Britton said. Come on, let's get to a phone. I'm having that guy picked up for questioning. It's the only thing to do. And I'll have some men go over Miss Dalton's room. We'll find out what happened. I'll bet my right arm that goddamn Red's up to something.
Britton went out, and Mr. Dalton followed, leaving Bigger still on the edge of the bed. When he heard the door slam, he got up and grabbed his cap and went softly down the stairs into the basement. He stood a moment looking through the cracks into the humming fire, blindingly red now. Then he went into the driveway, through the falling snow, to the street. He had to see Bessie at once. The kidnap note had to be sent right away. There was no time to lose. If Mr. Dalton, Britton, or Peggy missed him and asked him where he had been, he would say that he had gone out to get a package of cigarettes. But with all of the excitement, no one would probably think of him. And they were after Jan now. He was safe.
Bigger!
He stopped, whirled, his hand reaching inside of his shirt for his gun. He saw Jan standing in the doorway of a store. As Jan came forward, Bigger backed away. Jan stopped.
For Christ's sakes, don't be afraid of me. I'm not going to hurt you.
In the pale yellow sheen of the street lamp, they faced each other. Huge wet flakes of snow floated down slowly, forming a delicate screen between them. Bigger had his hand inside of his shirt, on his gun. Jan stood staring, his mouth open.
What's all this about, Bigger? I haven't done anything to you, have I? Where's Mary?
Bigger felt guilty. Jan's presence condemned him. Yet he knew of no way to atone for his guilt. He felt he had to act as he was acting.
I don't want to talk to you, he mumbled.
But what have I done to you?
Jan asked desperately. Jan had done nothing to him, and it was Jan's innocence that made anger rise in him. His fingers tightened about the gun.
I don't want to talk to you, he said again.
He felt that if Jan continued to stand there and make him feel this awful sense of guilt, he would have to shoot him in spite of himself. He began to tremble all over. His lips parted, and his eyes widened.
Go away, Bigger said.
Listen, Bigger, if these people are bothering you, just tell me. Don't be scared. I'm used to this sort of thing. Listen now, let's go somewhere and get a cup of coffee and talk this thing over.
Jan came forward again, and Bigger drew his gun. Jan stopped. His face whitened.
For God's sake, man! What are you doing? Don't shoot! I haven't bothered you! Don't!
Leave me alone, Bigger said, his voice tense and hysterical. Leave me alone! Leave me alone!
Jan backed away from him.
Leave me alone!
Bigger's voice rose to a scream. Jan backed farther away, then turned and walked rapidly off, looking back over his shoulder. When he reached the corner, he ran through the snow out of sight. Bigger stood still, the gun in hand. He had utterly forgotten where he was. His eyes were still riveted on that point in space where he had last seen Jan's retreating form. The tension in him slackened, and he lowered the gun until it hung at his side, loosely in his fingers. He was coming back into possession of himself. For the past 3 minutes, it seemed he had been under a strange spell, possessed by a force which he hated, but which he had to obey. He was startled when he heard soft footsteps coming toward him in the snow. He looked and saw a white woman. The woman saw him and paused. She turned abruptly and ran across the street. Bigger shoved the gun in his pocket and ran to the corner. He looked back. The woman was vanishing through the snow in the opposite direction. In him as he walked was a cold, driving will. He would go through with this. He would work fast. He had encountered in Jan a much stronger determination than he had thought would be there. If he sent the kidnap note, it would have to be done before Jan could prove that he was completely innocent. At that moment, he did not care if he was caught. If only he could cower Jan and Britton into awe, into fear of him and his black skin and his humble manners. He reached a corner and went into a drugstore. A white clerk came to him.
Give me an envelope, some paper, and a pencil, he said.
He paid the money, put the package into his pocket, and went out to the corner to wait for a car. One came. He got on and rode eastward, wondering what kind of note he would write. He rang the bell for the car to stop, got off, and walked through the quiet Negro streets. Now and then he passed an empty building, white and silent in the night. He would make Bessie hide in one of these buildings, and watch for Mr. Dalton's car. But the ones he passed were too old. If one went into them, they might collapse. He walked on. He had to find a building where Bessie could stand in a window and see the package of money when it was thrown from the car. He reached Langley Avenue and walked westward to Wabash Avenue. There were many empty buildings with black windows like blind eyes, buildings like skeletons standing with snow on their bones in the winter winds, but none of them were on corners. Finally, at Michigan Avenue and East 36th Place, he saw the one he wanted. It was tall, white, silent, standing on a well-lighted corner. By looking from any of the front windows, Bessie would be able to see in all four directions. Oh! He had to have a flashlight. He went to a drugstore and bought one for a dollar. He felt in the inner pocket of his coat for his gloves. Now he was ready. He crossed the street and stood waiting for a car. His feet were cold, and he stamped them in the snow, surrounded by people waiting, too, for a car. He did not look at them. They were simply blind people, blind like his mother, his brother, his sister, Peggy, Britton, Jan, Mr. Dalton, and the sightless Mrs. Dalton, and the quiet, empty houses with their black, gaping windows. He looked round the street and saw a sign on a building. This property is managed by the Southside Real Estate Company. He had heard that Mr. Dalton owned the Southside Real Estate Company, and the Southside Real Estate Company owned the house in which he lived. He paid $8 a week for one rat-infested room. He had never seen Mr. Dalton until he had come to work for him. His mother always took the rent to the real estate office. Mr. Dalton was somewhere far away, high up, distant, like a god. He owned property all over the Black Belt, and he owned property where white folks lived too. But Bigger could not live in a building across the line. Even though Mr. Dalton gave millions of dollars for Negro education, he would rent houses to Negroes only in this prescribed area, this corner of the city, tumbling down from rot. In a sullen way, Bigger was conscious of this. Yes, he would send the kidnap note. He would jar them out of their senses. When the car came, he rode south and got off at 51st Street and walked to Bessie's. He had to ring 5 times before the buzzer answered. God damn it, I bet she's drunk, he thought. He mounted the steps and saw her peering at him through the door with eyes red from sleep and alcohol. His doubt of her made him fearful and angry.
Bigger?
She asked. Get on back in the room, he said.
What's the matter?
She asked, backing away, her mouth open. Let me in. Open the door. She threw the door wide, almost stumbling as she did so. Turn on the light.
What's the matter, Bigger?
How many times do you want me to ask you to turn on the light? She turned it on. Pull them shades. She lowered the shades. He stood watching her. Now, I don't want any trouble out of her. He went to the dresser and pushed her jars and combs and brushes aside and took the package from his pocket and laid it in the cleared space.
Bigger?
He turned and looked at her. What?
You ain't really planning to do that, Shona.
What the hell you think?
Bigger, no.
He caught her arm and squeezed it in a grip of fear and hate. You ain't gonna turn away from me now. Not now, goddamn you. She said nothing. He took off his cap and coat and threw them on the bed.
They're wet, Bigger.
So what?
I ain't doing this, she said.
Like hell you ain't.
You can't make me.
You done helped me steal enough from the folks you work for to put you in jail already. She did not answer. He turned from her and got a chair and pulled it up to the dresser. He unwrapped the package and balled the paper into a knot and threw it into a corner of the room. Instinctively, Bessie stooped to pick it up. Bigger laughed, and she straightened suddenly. Yes. Bessie was blind. He was about to write a kidnap note, and she was worried about the cleanliness of her room.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"Nothing." He was smiling grimly. He took out the pencil. It was not sharpened. "Give me a knife."
"Ain't you got one?"
"Hell no. Give me a knife."
"What you do with your knife?"
He stared at her, remembering that she knew that he had had a knife. An image of blood gleaming on the metal blade in the glare of the furnace came before his eyes, and fear rose in him hotly. "You want me to slap you?" She went behind a curtain. He sat looking at the paper and pencil. She came back with a butcher knife.
"Bigger, please. I don't want to do it."
"Got any liquor?"
"Yeah."
"Get you a shot and sit on that bed and keep quiet." She stood undecided, then got the bottle from under a pillow and drank. She lay on the bed on her stomach, her face turned so that she could see him. He watched her through the looking glass of the dresser. He sharpened the pencil and spread out the piece of paper. He was about to write when he remembered that he did not have his gloves on. "Goddamn. Give me my gloves."
"Huh?"
"Get my gloves out of the inside of my coat pocket." She swayed to her feet and got the gloves and stood back of his chair, holding them limply in her hands. "Give them here."
"Bigger."
"Give me the gloves and get back on that bed, will you?" He snatched them from her and gave her a shove and turned back to the dresser.
"Bigger."
"I ain't asking you but once more to shut up," he said, pushing the knife out of the way so he could write. He put on the gloves and took up the pencil in a trembling hand and held it poised over the paper. He should disguise his handwriting. He changed the pencil from his right to his left hand. He would not write it. He would print it. He swallowed with dry throat. Now, what would be the best kind of note? He thought. "I want you to put 10,000. No. That would not do. Not I. It would be better to say, "We. We got your daughter." He printed slowly in big round letters. That was better. He ought to say something to let Mr. Dalton think that Mary was still alive. He wrote, "She is safe. Now, tell him not to go to the police." No. Say something about Mary first. He bent and wrote, "She wants to come home." Now, tell him not to go to the police. "Don't go to the police if you want your daughter back safe." No, that ain't good. His scalp tingled with excitement. It seemed that he could feel each strand of hair upon his head. He read the line over and crossed out, "safe," and wrote, "alive." For a moment he was frozen, still. There was in his stomach a slow, cold, vast, rising movement, as though he held within the embrace of his bowels the swing of planets through space. He was giddy. He caught hold of himself, focused his attention to write again. "Now, about the money." "How much?" "Yes. Make it 10,000. "Get 10,000 in 5 and 10 bills. And put it in a shoebox." "That's good." He had read that somewhere. "And tomorrow night, ride your car up and down Michigan Avenue from 35th Street to 40th Street. That would make it hard for anybody to tell just where Bessie would be hiding." He wrote, "Blink your headlights some. When you see a light in the window blink 3 times, throw the box in the snow and drive off. Do what this letter say." Now, he would sign it. But how? It should be signed in some way that would throw them off the trail. Oh, yes. Sign it. Red. He printed. Red. Then, for some reason, he thought that was not enough. Oh, yes. He would make one of those signs, like the ones he had seen on the communist pamphlets. He wondered how they were made. There was a hammer and a round kind of knife. He drew a hammer, then a curving knife, but it did not look right. He examined it and discovered that he had left the handle off the knife. He sketched it in. Now it was complete. He read it over. Oh! He had left out something. He had to put in the time when he wanted them to bring the money. He bent and printed again. P.S. Bring the money at midnight. He sighed, lifted his eyes, and saw Bessie standing behind him. He turned and looked at her.
Bigger, you ain't really going to do that,
she whispered in horror. Sure.
Where's that girl?
I don't know.
You do know. You wouldn't be doing this if you didn't know.
Oh, what difference do it make? She looked straight into his eyes and whispered,
Bigger, did you kill that girl?
His jaw clamped tight, and he stood up. She turned from him and flung herself upon the bed, sobbing. He began to feel cold. He discovered that his body was covered with sweat. He heard a soft rustle and looked down at his hand. The kidnap note was shaking in his trembling fingers. But I ain't scared, he told himself. He folded the note, put it into an envelope, sealed it by licking the flap, and shoved it in his pocket. He lay down on the bed beside Bessie and took her in his arms. He tried to speak to her and found his throat so husky that no words came. Come on, kid, he whispered finally.
Digger, what's happened to you?
It ain't nothing. You ain't got much to do.
I don't want to.
Don't be scared.
You told me you was never going to kill nobody.
I ain't killed nobody.
You did. I see it in your eyes. I see it all over you.
Don't you trust me, baby?
Where's that girl, Bigger?
I don't know.
How you know she won't turn up?
She just won't.
You did kill her.
Oh, forget the girl. She stood up.
If you killed her, you'll kill me, she said. I ain't in this.
Don't be a fool. I love you.
You told me you never was going to kill.
All right. They white folks. They done killed plenty of us.
That don't make it right.
He began to doubt her. He had never heard this tone in her voice before. He saw her tear-wet eyes looking at him in stark fear, and he remembered that no one had seen him leave his room. To stop Bessie, who now knew too much, would be easy. He could take the butcher knife and cut her throat. He had to make certain of her, one way or the other, before he went back to Dalton's. Quickly, he stooped over her, his fists clenched. He was feeling as he had felt when he stood over Mary's bed, with a white blur drawing near. An iota more of fear would have sent him plunging again into murder. I don't want no playing from you now.
I'm scared, Bigger,
she whimpered. She tried to get up. He knew she had seen the mad light in his eyes. Fear sheathed him in fire. His words came in a thick whisper. Keep still now. I ain't playing. Pretty soon they'll be after me, maybe. And I ain't gonna let them catch me, see? I ain't gonna let them. The first thing they'll do in looking for me is to come to you. They'll grill you about me and you drunk fool, you'll tell. You'll tell if you ain't in it, too. If you ain't in it for your life, you'll tell.
Nah, Bigger.
She whimpered tensely. At that moment, she was too scared even to cry.
You going to do what I say?
She wrenched herself free and rolled across the bed and stood up on the other side. He ran round the bed and followed her as she backed into a corner. His voice hissed from his throat.
I ain't gonna leave you behind to snitch.
I ain't gonna snitch. I swear I ain't.
He held his face a few inches from hers. He had to bind her to him.
Yeah, I killed the girl, he said. Now you know. You got to help me. You in it as deep as me. You done spent some of the money.
She sank to the bed again, sobbing, her breath catching in her throat. He stood looking down at her, waiting for her to be quiet. When she had control of herself, he lifted her and stood her upon her feet. He reached under the pillow and brought out the bottle and took out the stopper and put his hand round her and tilted her head. Here, take a shot.
No.
Drink.
He carried the bottle to her lips. She drank a small swallow. When he attempted to put the bottle away, she took it from him.
That's enough now. You don't want to get sloppy drunk.
He turned her loose, and she lay back on the bed, limp, whimpering. He bent to her.
Listen, Bessie.
Bigger, please. Don't do this to me, please. All I do is work, work like a dog, from morning till night. I ain't got no happiness. I ain't never had none. I ain't got nothing, and you do this to me? After how good I've been to you? Now you just spoil my whole life. I've done everything for you I know how, and you do this to me? Please, Bigger.
She turned her head away and stared at the floor.
Lord, don't let this happen to me. I ain't done nothing for this to come to me. I just work. I ain't had no happiness, no nothing. I just work. I'm black and I work and I don't bother nobody.
Gone, Bigger said, nodding his head affirmatively. He knew the truth of all she spoke without her telling it. Go on and see what that gets you.
But I don't want to do it, Bigger. They'll catch us. God knows they will.
I ain't going to leave you here to snitch on me.
I won't tell. Honest, I won't. I cross my heart and swear by God I won't. You can run away.
I ain't got no money.
You have got money. I paid rent out of what you gave me, and I bought some liquor, but the rest is there.
That ain't enough. I got to have some real dough.
She cried again. He got the knife and stood over her.
I can stop it all right now, he said.
She started up, her mouth opening to scream.
If you scream, I have to kill you, so help me God.
No, no, Bigger, don't.
Slowly, his arm relaxed and hung at his side. She fell to sobbing again. He was afraid that he would have to kill her before it was all over. She would not do to take along, and he could not leave her behind.
All right, he said. But you better do the right thing.
He put the knife on the dresser and got the flashlight from his overcoat pocket, and then stood over her with the letter and flashlight in his hand.
Come on, he said. Get your coat on.
Not tonight, Bigger. Not tonight.
It won't be tonight, but I got to show you what to do.
But it's cold. It's snowing.
Sure, and nobody'll see us. Come on.
She pulled up. He watched her struggle into her coat. Now and then she paused and looked at him, blinking back her tears. When she was dressed, he put on his coat and cap and led her to the street. The air was thick with snow. The wind blew hard. It was a blizzard. The street lamps were faint smudges of yellow. They walked to the corner and waited for a car.
I'd rather do anything but this, she said.
Stop now. We're in it.
Bigger, honey, I'd run off with you. I'd work for you, baby. We don't have to do this. Don't you believe I love you?
Don't try that on me now.
The car came. He helped her on and sat down beside her and looked past her face at the silent snow flying white and wild outside the window. He brought his eyes farther round and looked at her. She was staring with blank eyes, like a blind woman waiting for some word to tell her where she was going. Once she cried, and he gripped her shoulder so tightly that she stopped, more absorbed in the painful pressure of steel-like fingers than in her fate. They got off at 36th Place and walked over to Michigan Avenue. When they reached the corner, Bigger stopped and made her stop by gripping her arm again. They were in front of a high, white, empty building with black windows.
Where are we going?
Right here.
Bigger,
she whimpered.
Come on now, don't start that.
But I don't want to.
You got to.
He looked up and down the street, past ghostly lamps that shed a long series of faintly shimmering cones of yellow against the snowy night. He took her to the front entrance, which gave into a vast pool of inky silence. He brought out the flashlight and focused the round spot on a rickety stairway leading upward into a still blacker darkness. The planks creaked as he led her up. Now and then, he felt his shoes sink into a soft, cushy substance. Cobwebs brushed his face. All round him was the dank smell of rotting timber. He stopped abruptly, as something with dry, whispering feet flitted across his path, emitting as the rush of its flight died a thin, piping wail of lonely fear.
Ow!
Bigger whirled and centered the spot of light on Bessie's face. Her lips were drawn back, her mouth was open, and her hands were lifted midway to white-rimmed eyes.
What you trying to do? He asked. Tell the whole world we're in here?
Oh, Bigger.
Come on.
After a few feet, he stopped and swung the light. He saw dusty walls, walls almost like those of the Dalton home. The doorways were wider than those of any house in which he had ever lived. Some rich folks lived here once, he thought. Rich white folks. That was the way most houses on the south side were, ornate, old, stinking. Homes once of rich white people, now inhabited by Negroes, or standing dark and empty with yawning black windows. He remembered that bombs had been thrown by whites into houses like these when Negroes had first moved into the south side. He swept the disk of yellow and walked gingerly down a hall and into a room at the front of the house. It was feebly lit from the street lamps outside. He switched off the flashlight and looked round. The room had six large windows. By standing close to any of them, the streets in all four directions were visible.
See, Bessie?
He turned to look at her and found that she was not there. He called tensely.
Bessie!
There was no answer. He bounded to the doorway and switched on the flashlight. She was leaning against a wall, sobbing. He went to her, caught her arm, and yanked her back into the room.
Come on. You got to do better than this.
I'd rather have you kill me right now, she sobbed.
Don't you say that again.
She was silent. His black, open palm swept upward in a swift, narrow arc and smacked solidly against her face.
You want me to wake you up?
She bent her head to her knees. He caught hold of her arm again and dragged her to the window. He spoke like a man who had been running and was out of breath.
Now look, all you got to do is come here tomorrow night, see? Ain't nothing going to bother you. I'm seeing everything. Don't you worry none. You just do what I say. You come here and just watch. About 12 o'clock, a car will come along. It'll be blinking its headlights, see? When it comes, you just raise this flashlight and blink it 3 times, see? Like this. Remember that. Then watch that car.
it'll throw out a package. Watch that package, because the money'll be in it. It'll go into the snow. Look and see if anybody's about. If you see nobody, then go and get the package and go home. But don't go straight home. Make sure nobody's watching you. Nobody's following you, see? Ride 3 or 4 streetcars and transfer fast. Get off about 5 blocks from home and look behind you as you walk, see? Now look. You can see up and down Michigan in 36. You can see if anybody's watching. I'll be in the white folks' house all day tomorrow. If they put anybody out to watch, I'll let you know not to come.
Bigger.
Come on now.
Take me home.
You going to do it?
She did not answer.
You already in it, he said. You got part of the money.
I reckon it don't make no difference,
she sighed.
It'll be easy.
It won't. I get caught. But it don't make no difference. I'm lost anyhow. I was lost when I took up with you. I'm lost and it don't matter.
Come on.
He led her back to the car stop. He said nothing as they waited in the whirling snow. When he heard the car coming, he took her purse from her, opened it, and put the flashlight inside. The car stopped. He helped her on, put 7 cents in her trembling hand, and stood in the snow watching her black face through the window, white with ice, as the car moved off slowly through the night.
This ends Disc 6. Native Son, Disc 7.
He walked to Dalton's through the snow. His right hand was in his coat pocket, his fingers about the kidnap note. When he reached the driveway, he looked about the street carefully. There was no one. He looked at the house. It was white, huge, silent. He walked up the steps and stood in front of the door. He waited a moment to see what would happen. So deeply conscious was he of violating dangerous taboo that he felt the very air or sky would suddenly speak, commanding him to stop. He was sailing fast into the face of a cold wind that all but sucked his breath from him, but he liked it. Around him were silence and night and snow falling, falling as though it had fallen from the beginning of time and would always fall till the end of the world. He took the letter out of his pocket and slipped it under the door. Turning, he ran down the steps and round the house.
I'd done it. I'd done it now. They'll see it tonight or in the morning.
He went to the basement door, opened it, and looked inside. No one was there. Like an enraged beast, the furnace throbbed with heat, suffusing a red glare over everything. He stood in front of the cracks and watched the restless embers. Had Mary burned completely? He wanted to poke around in the coals to see, but dared not. He flinched from it even in thought. He pulled the lever for more coal, then went to his room. When he stretched out on his bed in the dark, he found that his whole body was trembling. He was cold and hungry. While lying there shaking, a hot bath of fear, hotter than his blood, engulfed him, bringing him to his feet. He stood in the middle of the floor, seeing vivid images of his gloves, his pencil, and paper. How on earth had he forgotten them? He had to burn them. He would do it right now. He pulled on the light and went to his overcoat and got the gloves and pencil and paper and stuffed them into his shirt. He went to the door, listened a moment, then went into the hall and down the stairs to the furnace. He stood a moment before the gleaming cracks. Hurriedly, he opened the door and dumped the gloves and pencil and paper in. He watched them smoke, blaze. He closed the door and heard them burn in a furious whirlwind of draft. A strange sensation enveloped him. Something tingled in his stomach and on his scalp. His knees wobbled, giving way. He stumbled to the wall and leaned against it weakly. A wave of numbness spread fanwise from his stomach over his entire body including his head and eyes, making his mouth gap. Strength ebbed from him. He sank to his knees and pressed his fingers to the floor to keep from tumbling over. An organic sense of dread seized him. His teeth chattered, and he felt sweat sliding down his armpits and back. He groaned, holding as still as possible. His vision was blurred, but gradually it cleared. Again he saw the furnace. Then he realized that he had been on the verge of collapse. Soon the glare and drone of the fire came to his eyes and ears. He closed his mouth and gritted his teeth. The peculiar, paralyzing numbness was leaving. When he was strong enough to stand without support, he rose to his feet and wiped his forehead on his sleeve. He had strained himself from a too long lack of sleep and food, and the excitement was sapping his energy. He should go to the kitchen and ask for his dinner. Surely, he should not starve like this. He mounted the steps to the door and knocked timidly. There was no answer. He turned the knob and pushed the door in and saw the kitchen flooded with light. On a table were spread several white napkins, under which was something that looked like plates of food. He stood gazing at it, then went to the table and lifted the corners of the napkins. There were sliced bread and steak and fried potatoes and gravy and string beans and spinach and a huge piece of chocolate cake. His mouth watered. Was this for him? He wondered if Peggy was around. Ought he try to find her? But he disliked the thought of looking for her. That would bring attention to himself, something which he hated. He stood in the kitchen, wondering if he ought to eat, but afraid to do so. He rested his black fingers on the edge of the white table, and a silent laugh burst from his parted lips as he saw himself for a split second in a lurid, objective light. He had killed a rich white girl, and had burned her body after cutting her head off, and had lied to throw the blame on someone else, and had written a kidnap note demanding $10,000, and yet he stood here, afraid to touch food on the table. Food, which undoubtedly was his own.
Bigger!
Huh? He answered before he knew who had called.
Where have you been? Your dinner's been waiting for you since 5 o'clock. There's a chair. Eat as much as you want.
He stopped listening. In Peggy's hand was the kidnap note.
I'll heat your coffee. Go ahead and eat.
Had she opened it? Did she know what was in it? No. The envelope was still sealed. She came to the table and removed the napkins. His knees were shaking with excitement, and sweat broke out in his forehead. His skin felt as though it were puckering up from a blast of heat.
Don't you want the steak warmed?
The question reached him from far away, and he shook his head without really knowing what she meant.
Don't you feel well?
This is all right, he murmured.
You oughtn't starve yourself that way.
I wasn't hungry.
You're hungrier than you think, she said.
She set a cup and saucer at his plate, then laid the letter on the edge of the table. It held his attention as though it were a steel magnet and his eyes were iron. She got the coffee pot and poured his cup full. No doubt, she had just gotten the letter from under the door and had not yet had time to give it to Mr. Dalton. She placed a small jar of cream at his plate and took up the letter again.
I've got to give this to Mr. Dalton, she said. I'll be back in a moment.
Yes'm, he whispered. She laughed. He stopped chewing and stared before him, his mouth dry. But he had to eat. Not to eat now would create suspicion. He shoved the food in and chewed each mouthful a while, then washed it down with swallows of hot coffee. When the coffee gave out, he used cold water. He strained his ears to catch sounds, but none came. Then the door swung in silently, and Peggy came back. He could see nothing in her round red face. Out of the corners of his eyes, he watched her go to the stove and putter with pots and pans.
Want more coffee?
No.
You ain't scared of all this trouble we're having round here, are you, Bigger?
Oh, no, he said, wondering if something in his manner had made her ask that.
That poor Mary, Peggy sighed. She acts like such a ninny. Imagine, a girl keeping her parents worried sick all the time. But there are children for you these days.
He hurried with his eating, saying nothing. He wanted to get out of the kitchen. The thing was in the open now. Not all of it, but some of it. Nobody knew about Mary yet. He saw in his mind a picture of the Dalton family, distraught and horrified when they found that Mary was kidnapped. That would put them a certain distance from him. They would think that white men did it. They would never think that a black, timid Negro did that. They would go after Jan. The red he had signed to the letter, and the hammer and curving knife would make them look for communists.
You got enough?
Yes'm.
You better clean the ashes out of the furnace in the morning, Bigger.
Yes'm.
And be ready for Mr. Dalton at 8.
Yes'm.
Your room all right?
Yes'm.
The door swung in violently. Bigger started in fright. Mr. Dalton came into the kitchen, his face ashy. He stared at Peggy, and Peggy, holding a dish towel in her hand, stared at him. In Mr. Dalton's hand was the letter, opened.
What's the matter, Mr. Dalton?
Who gave you this?
What?
This letter.
Why, nobody. I got it from the door.
When?
A few minutes ago. Anything wrong?
Mr. Dalton looked round the entire kitchen, not at anything in particular, but just round the entire stretch of four walls, his eyes wide and unseeing. He looked back at Peggy. It was as if he had thrown himself upon her mercy, was waiting for her to say some word that would take the horror away.
Well, what's the matter, Mr. Dalton?
Peggy asked again. But before Mr. Dalton could answer, Mrs. Dalton groped her way into the kitchen, her white hands held high. Bigger watched her fingers tremble through the air till they touched Mr. Dalton's shoulder. They gripped his coat, hard enough to tear it from his body. Bigger, without moving an eyelid, felt his skin grow hot and his muscles stiffen.
Henry! Henry!
Mrs. Dalton called.
What's the matter?
Mr. Dalton did not hear her. He still stared at Peggy.
Did you see who left this letter?
No, Mr. Dalton.
You, Bigger?
No, sir,
he whispered, his mouth full of dry food.
Henry, tell me, please, for heaven's sake.
Mr. Dalton put his arm about Mrs. Dalton's waist and held her close to him.
It's about Mary. It's... she...
What? Where is she?
They got her. They kidnapped her.
Henry, no!
Mrs. Dalton screamed.
Oh, no!
Peggy whimpered, running to Mr. Dalton.
My baby,
Mrs. Dalton sobbed.
She's been kidnapped,
Mr. Dalton said, as though he had to say the words over again to convince himself. Bigger's eyes were wide, taking in all three of them in one constantly roving glance. Mrs. Dalton continued to sob, and Peggy sank into a chair, her face in her hands. Then she sprang up and ran out of the room, crying,
Lord, don't let them kill her.
Mrs. Dalton swayed. Mr. Dalton lifted her and staggered, trying to get her through the door. As he watched Mr. Dalton, there flashed through Bigger's mind a quick image of how he had lifted Mary's body in his arms the night before. He rose and held the door open for Mr. Dalton,
and watched him walk unsteadily down the dim hallway with Mrs. Dalton in his arms. He was alone in the kitchen now. Again, the thought that he had the chance to walk out of here and be clear of it all came to him, and again, he brushed it aside. He was tensely eager to stay and see how it would all end, even if that end swallowed him in blackness. He felt that he was living upon a high pinnacle where bracing winds whipped about him. There came to his ears a muffled sound of sobs. Then suddenly there was silence. What's happening? Would Mr. Dalton phone the police now? He strained to listen, but no sounds came. He went to the door and took a few steps into the hallway. There were still no sounds. He looked about to make sure that no one was watching him, then crept on tiptoe down the hall. He heard voices. Mr. Dalton was talking to someone. He crept farther. Yes, he could hear. I want to talk to Britton, please. Mr. Dalton was phoning. Come right over, please. Yes, at once, something awful has happened. I don't want to talk about it over the phone. That meant that when Britton came back, he would be questioned again. Yes, right away. I'll be waiting. He had to get back to his room. He tiptoed along the hall, through the kitchen, down the steps, and into the basement. The torrid cracks of the furnace gleamed in the crimson darkness, and he heard the throaty undertone of the draft devouring the air. Was she burnt? But even if she were not, who would think of looking in the furnace for her? He went to his room, into the closet, closed the door, and listened. Silence. He came out, left the door open, and in order to get to the closet quickly and without sound, pulled off his shoes. He lay again on the bed, his mind whirling, with images born of a multitude of impulses. He could run away. He could remain. He could even go down and confess what he had done. The mere thought that these avenues of action were open to him made him feel free, that his life was his, that he held his future in his hands. But they would never think that he had done it, not a meek black boy like him. He bounded off the bed, listening, thinking that he had heard voices. He had been so deeply taken up with his own thoughts that he did not know if he had actually heard anything or had imagined it. Yes, he heard faint footsteps below. He hurried to the closet. The footsteps ceased. There came to him the soft sound of sobbing. It was Peggy. Her sobbing quieted, then rose to a high pitch. He stood for a long time, listening to Peggy's sobs, and the long moan of the wind sweeping through the night outside. Peggy's sobs ceased, and her footsteps sounded once more. Was she going to answer the doorbell? Footsteps came again. Peggy had gone to the front of the house for something, and had come back. He heard a heavy voice, a man's. At first he could not identify it. Then he realized that it was Britton's.
And you found the note?
Yes.
How long ago?
About an hour.
You're sure you didn't see anyone leave it?
It was sticking under the door.
Think now. Did you see anybody about the house or driveway?
No. The boy and me. That's all that's been around here.
And where's the boy now?
Upstairs in his room, I think.
Did you ever see this handwriting before?
No, Mr. Britton.
Can you guess? Can you think, imagine, who would send such a note?
No. Not a soul in this whole wide world, Mr. Britton, Peggy wailed.
Britton's voice ceased. There was the sound of other heavy feet. Chairs scraped over the floor. More people were in the kitchen. Who were they? Their movements sounded like those of men. Then Bigger heard Britton speaking again.
Listen, Peggy. Tell me, how does this boy act?
What do you mean, Mr. Britton?
Does he seem intelligent? Does he seem to be acting?
I don't know, Mr. Britton. He's just like all the other colored boys.
Does he say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am?
Yes, Mr. Britton, he's polite.
But does he seem to be trying to appear like he's more ignorant than he really is?
I don't know, Mr. Britton.
Have you missed anything around the house since he's been here?
No, nothing.
Has he ever insulted you or anything?
Oh, no, no.
What kind of a boy is he?
He's just a quiet colored boy. That's all I can say.
Did you ever see him reading anything?
No, Mr. Britton.
Does he speak more intelligently at some times than at others?
No, Mr. Britton. He talked always the same to me.
Has he ever done anything that would make you think he knows something about this note?
No, Mr. Britton.
When you speak to him, does he hesitate before he answers, as though he's thinking up what to say?
No, Mr. Britton, he talks and acts natural-like.
When he talks, does he wave his hands around a lot, like he's been around a lot of Jews?
I've never noticed, Mr. Britton.
Did you ever hear him call anybody comrade?
No, Mr. Britton.
Does he pull off his cap when he comes in the house?
I never noticed. I think so, Mr. Britton.
Has he ever sat down in your presence without being asked, like he was used to being around white people?
No, Mr. Britton. Only when I told him to.
Does he speak first, or does he wait until he's spoken to?
Well, Mr. Britton, he seemed always to wait until we spoke to him before he said anything.
Now listen, Peggy. Think and try to remember if his voice goes up when he talks, like Jews when they talk. Know what I mean?
You see, Peggy, I'm trying to find out if he's been around communists. No, Mr. Dalton. He talks just like all other colored folks to me.
Where did you say he is now?
Upstairs in his room.
When Britton's voice ceased, Bigger was smiling. Yes. Britton was trying to trap him, trying to make out a case against him, but he could not find anything to go upon. Was Britton coming to talk to him now? There came the sound of other voices. It's a 10-to-1 chance that she's dead.
Yeah, they usually bump 'em off. They're scared of 'em after they get 'em. They think they might identify them afterwards.
Did the old man say he was going to pay?
Sure. He wants his daughter back.
That's just $10,000 shot to hell, if you ask me.
But he wants the girl. Say, I bet it's those Reds trying to raise money.
Yeah.
Maybe that's how they get their dough. They say that guy, Bruno Hauptmann, the one who snatched the Lindy baby, did it for the Nazis. They needed the money.
I'd like to shoot every one of them goddamn bastards, red or no red.
There was the sound of a door opening, and more footsteps.
You have any luck with the old man?
Not yet.
It was Britton's voice.
He's pretty washed up, eh?
Yeah, and who wouldn't be?
He won't call the cops?
Nah, he's scared stiff.
It might seem hard on the family, but if you let them snatchers know they can't scare money out of you, they'll stop.
Say, Brit, try him again.
Yeah, tell him there ain't nothing to do now but to call the cops.
Oh, I don't know. I hate to worry him.
Well, after all, it's his daughter. Let him handle it.
But listen, Brit, when they pick up this Erlone fella, he's going to tell the cops and the papers will have the story anyway. So call them now. The sooner they get started, the better.
Nah. I'll wait for the old man to give the signal.
Bigger knew that Mr. Dalton had not wanted to notify the police. That much was certain. But how long would he hold out?
The police would know everything as soon as Jan was picked up, for Jan would tell enough to make the police and the newspapers investigate. But if Jan were confronted with the fact of the kidnapping of Mary, what would happen? Could Jan prove an alibi? If he did, then the police would start looking for someone else. They would start questioning him again. They would want to know why he had lied about Jan's being in the house. But would not the word "red," which he had signed to the ransom note, throw them off the track and make them still think that Jan or his comrades did it? Why would anybody want to think that Bigger had kidnapped Mary? Bigger came out of the closet and wiped sweat from his forehead with his sleeve. He had knelt so long that his blood had almost stopped, and needle-like pains shot from the bottom of his feet to the calves of his legs. He went to the window and looked out at the swirling snow. He could hear wind rising. It was a blizzard, all right. The snow moved in no given direction, but filled the world with a vast white storm of flying powder. The sharp currents of wind could be seen in whirls of snow, twisting like miniature tornadoes. The window overlooked an alley, to the right of which was 45th Street. He tried the window to see if it would open. He lifted it a few inches, then all the way with a loud and screechy sound. Had anyone heard him? He waited. Nothing happened. Good. If the worst came to the worst, he could jump out of this window right here and run away. It was two stories to the ground, and there was a deep drift of snow just below him. He lowered the window and lay again on the bed, waiting. The sound of firm feet came on the stairs. Yes, someone was coming up. His body grew rigid. A knock came at the door.
Yes, sir.
Open up. He pulled on the light, opened the door, and met a white face.
They want you downstairs.
Yes, sir. The man stepped to one side, and Bigger went past him, on down the hall, and down the steps into the basement, feeling the eyes of the white man on his back, and hearing as he neared the furnace the muffled breathing of the fire, and seeing directly before his eyes Mary's bloody head, with its jet-black curly hair shining and wet with blood on the crumpled newspapers. He saw Britton, standing near the furnace with three white men.
Hello, Bigger.
Yes, sir, Bigger said.
You heard what happened?
Yes, sir.
Listen, boy. You're talking just to me and my men here. Now tell me, do you think Jan's mixed up in this?
Bigger's eyes fell. He did not want to answer in a hurry, and he did not want to blame Jan definitely, for that would make them question him too closely. He would hint and point in Jan's direction.
I don't know, sir, he said.
Just tell me what you think.
I don't know, sir,
Bigger said again.
You really saw him here last night, didn't you?
Oh, yes, sir.
You'd swear he told you to take that trunk down and leave the car out in the snow?
I'd swear it was true, sir, said Bigger.
Did he act like he had anything up his sleeve?
I don't know, sir.
What time did you say you left?
A little before two, sir.
Britton turned to the other men, one of whom stood near the furnace with his back to the fire, warming his hands behind him. The man's legs were sprawled wide apart, and a cigar glowed in a corner of his mouth.
It must have been that red, Britton said to him.
Yeah, said the man at the furnace.
What would he have the boy take the trunk down for and leave the car out?
It was to throw us off the scent.
Listen, Bigger, said Britton. Did you see this guy act in any way out of the ordinary? I mean, sort of nervous, say. Just what did he talk about?
He talked about communists.
Did he ask you to join?
He gave me that stuff to read.
Come on, tell us some of the things he said.
Bigger knew the things that white folks hated to hear Negroes ask for. And he knew that these were the things the Reds were always asking for. And he knew that white folks did not like to hear these things asked for, even by whites who fought for Negroes. Well, Bigger said, feigning reluctance. He told me that someday there wouldn't be no rich folks and no poor folks.
Yeah?
And he said a black man would have a chance.
Go on.
And he said there would be no more lynching.
And what was the girl saying?
She agreed with him.
How did you feel toward them?
I don't know, sir.
I mean, did you like them?
He knew that the average white man would not approve of his liking such talk. It was my job. I just did what they told me, he mumbled.
Did the girl act in any way scared?
He sensed what kind of a case they were trying to build against Jan, and he remembered that Mary had cried last night when he had refused to go into the cafe with her to eat. Well, I don't know, sir. She was crying once.
Crying?
The men crowded about him. Yes, sir.
Did he hit her?
I didn't see that.
What did he do then?
Well, he put his arms around her and she stopped. Bigger had his back to a wall. The crimson luster of the fire gleamed on the white men's faces. The sound of air being sucked upward through the furnace mingled in Bigger's ears with the faint whine of the wind outside in the night. He was tired. He closed his eyes a long second and then opened them, knowing that he had to keep alert and answer questions to save himself.
Did this fellow Jan say anything to you about white women?
Bigger tightened with alarm. Sir?
Did he say he would let you meet some white women if you joined the Reds?
He knew that sex relations between blacks and whites were repulsive to most white men. No, sir, he said, simulating abashment.
Did Jan lay the girl?
I don't know, sir.
Did you take them to a room or a hotel?
No, sir. Just to the park.
They were in the back seat?
Yes, sir.
How long were you in the park?
Well, about 2 hours, I reckon, sir.
Come on now, boy. Did he lay the girl?
I don't know, sir. They was back there kissing and going on.
Was she lying down?
Well, yes, sir. She was, said Bigger, lowering his eyes because he felt that it would be better to do so. He knew that whites thought that all Negroes yearned for white women. Therefore, he wanted to show a certain fearful deference, even when one's name was mentioned in his presence.
They were drunk, weren't they?
Yes, sir. They've been drinking a lot. He heard the sound of autos coming into the driveway. Was this the police?
Who's that? Britton asked.
I don't know, said one of the men.
I'd better see,
Britton said. Bigger saw, after Britton had opened the door, 4 cars standing in the snow with headlights glowing.
Who's that?
Britton called.
The press! There's nothing here for you,
Britton called in an uneasy voice.
Don't stall us, a voice answered. Some of it's already in the papers. You may as well tell the rest. What's in the papers?
Britton asked as the men entered the basement. A tall, red-faced man shoved his hand into his pocket and brought forth a newspaper and handed it to Britton.
The Reds say you're charging him with spiriting away the old man's daughter.
Bigger darted a glance at the paper from where he was. He saw, Red nabbed as girl vanishes.
God damn, said Britton.
Phew,
said the tall, red-faced man. What a night! Red arrested? Snowstorm? This place down here looks like somebody's been murdered.
Come on, you, said Britton. You're in Mr. Dalton's house now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Where's the old man?
Upstairs. He doesn't want to be bothered.
Is that girl really missing, or is this just a stunt?
I can't tell you anything, Britton said.
Who's this boy here?
Keep quiet, Bigger, Britton said.
Is he the one Erlone said accused him? Bigger stood against the wall and looked round vaguely.
You going to pull the dumb act on us? Asked one of the men. Listen, you guys, said Britton. Take it easy. I'll go and see if the old man will see you.
That's the time. We're waiting. All the wires are carrying this story. Britton went up the steps and left Bigger standing with the crowd of men.
Your name's Bigger Thomas? The red-faced man asked.
Keep quiet, Bigger, said one of Britton's men. Bigger said nothing. Say, what's all this? This boy can talk if he wants to.
This smells like something big to me, said one of the men.
Bigger had never seen such men before. He did not know how to act toward them, or what to expect of them. They were not rich and distant like Mr. Dalton, and they were harder than Britton, but in a more impersonal way, a way that maybe was more dangerous than Britton's. Back and forth, they walked across the basement floor in the glare of the furnace, with their hats on, and with cigars and cigarettes in their mouths. Bigger felt in them a coldness that disregarded everybody. They seemed like men out for keen sport. They would be around a long time now that Jan had been arrested and questioned. Just what did they think of what he had told about Jan? Was there any good in Britton's telling him not to talk to them? Bigger's eyes watched the bald newspaper in a white man's gloved hand. If only he could read that paper. The men were silent, waiting for Britton to return. Then one of them came and leaned against the wall near him. Bigger looked out of the corner of his eyes and said nothing. He saw the men light a cigarette.
Smoke, kid?
Nah, sir, he mumbled. He felt something touch the center of his palm. He made a move to look, but a whisper checked him.
Keep still. It's for you. I want you to give me the dope.
Bigger's fingers closed over a